Hello and welcome to Personal Journeys to Difficult Truths, Understanding Islam, Understanding the West. This is Elsa, and today I have with me Nikolai Senals. Hello, Nikolai.
Yeah, hi Elsa, and thank you for calling. Very nice to talk to you.
I'm delighted to have you. I came across one of your articles in Jihad Watch. It was on the differences between Muslim and non-Muslim prisoners. And I said, this is really exciting stuff. You were comparing Western psychology and Muslim psychology. And it made so much sense. It came across to me as really important findings. You also really had to figure out on your own that you really wanted to do this because in Denmark, there was some attention to criminal foreigners. You found out that all non-Muslim foreigners were less criminal than Danes, but Muslim foreigners were incredibly more likely to engage in criminal activity. For example, Muslims make up about 5% of the population and 70% of the prison population. So what was going on here? You're looking at the psychology and linking it with Islam, really important stuff. By the way, I don't think it'll surprise a lot of people that you were not met with a lot of delight, and in fact, you were asked to leave your job. But anyway, I'm sure we'll hear a lot about that, and right now, welcome Nikolai.
Yeah, hi, Yasmin. Thank you. Yeah, nice to talk to you.
I'm fascinated. Who was the boy who grew up to be Nikolai Senals? Were you always interested in psychology? What were you like?
Well, you almost sound like a psychologist. Well, I grew up as a hippie, actually. I spent a lot of my time around campfires when I was small with my parents and their friends. We played guitar and did the things and smoked the things that hippies did at that time. There was a lot of talk about women's liberation. I remember when we moved to a bit better neighborhood. The neighbors were quite shocked that my mother walked around in the garden with nothing but some short trousers. it was happy days with a lot of flowers and it was nice.
It sounds like you had rather unconventional parents.
Yeah, to some people it would seem quite unconventional, but it was the hippie times at that time in Denmark, mm-hmm. With still some the Beatles and Rolling Stones and the late hippie times, you would call it.
Okay, but it doesn't sound like, because now you are incredibly outspoken and you are outside politically correct majority viewpoints. Was there anything in your boyhood that would indicate that you'd stand firm in what you saw or that you'd be outspoken? I just say that because so many people aren't. Now, the facts that you're presenting, it's not like no one else could find them.
No. Well, I never thought about that, but I don't think so. It's more that, well, the values that I was brought up to care about was at that time considered very leftist, actually.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it was about, you know, being very critical towards religion. The Marxist slogan, religion is opium for the people. We were brought up to speak against those in power in case we thought they were wrong and not just shut up. We should really use our free speech. And also the equality of women were very central in the political setting that I grew up in. So, and that's the values that I still keep today. For me, it feels like, some say I changed, changed from left to right or from liberal to conservative. But for me, it seems that more it's left and right, they switched sides. I'm still the one I was and believe in the same values, but it seems that now it's considered conservative to think that women should be equal and so on.
Your experience is one that I think is shared with many people. I've always considered myself left and human rights. I was brought up women's rights, racial rights, gay rights. I mean, I was rights. To me, it just seemed like that was the way to go. And so, in fact, it stunned me what's been happening. Mm-hmm. Okay, so you grew up, in other words, with what's kind of a mainstream viewpoint, you know, women's rights, etc. How did you come to your interest in Islam? What happened before that?
Well, there was a few rough cases in Copenhagen. I lived in Copenhagen at that time. There was a few rough cases with some Muslim immigrants attacking and raping young women on the street in the middle of Copenhagen, and it kind of opened my interest in who are these people, and because it seems so un-Danish, you would call it. It just seems so, you hadn't heard about things like that before.
How long ago was that?
One of the cases involved four young Muslims who dragged a young woman by the hair through a walking street, the main walking street of Copenhagen. You may have been there.
Yes, beautiful.
And raped in a side street, and nobody, even though many people saw it, nobody stepped in and stopped what's going on.
No Danish person.
Surprised and shocked and perplexed, because it's not something you would read about in the newspaper before that. And so that started my interest. And for some reason, I actually ended up because I was working in some institutions for young people, pedagogical institutions, I actually ended up with taking care of three of those four young men and got to get to know them and their culture. And that kind of turned on my interest to the whole subject.
How long ago was this?
This is... It's more like 12, 13 years ago.
So a little bit before 9/11 even.
Yeah, it was before 9/11.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And you're telling me Danish people, Christian Danish or atheist Danish, nobody intervened. They let this rape happen.
That was maybe the most shocking of it all, that people just stood there and watched what's going on and didn't simply step in. Yeah, that was very embarrassing, very shocking. And my own way of being shocked about it maybe also have turned me on to think that somebody has to do something. Mm-hmm. And then then a few years later I started writing letters to the editors, to newspapers.
What were your letters to the editor about?
At that time, there was an obvious lack of knowledge about statistics on Muslim crime and I started to look around for bits and pieces of information on the subject, and I ended up piecing together quite long essay that was printed in one big internet magazine, and soon after that, I remember, I think the first letter I ever had printed in a newspaper, I suggested that if we want to get rid of Islamic terrorism, we should forbid the Quran. I think it was like that.
I'm sorry I cut you off earlier. You were saying that you were dealing with these three young men. Is there anything you learned from your experience with these three young men who had raped the woman in plain sight of others?
Well, they had more or less the same attitude that you would meet as many Arab young men. You know, they're in some ways very self-confident, but on the other hand also very, very fragile. You know, they come out very self-confident, but as soon as you criticize them a little bit or challenge them a bit, they become very aggressive and very insecure. And then the view on women was detesting. Yeah.
Did you feel you could make any headway with them in getting them to recognize what a crime they had committed or anything?
At that time, I didn't really try, but I don't think I would have been able to. not in that setting. I was not a psychologist at that time. I was still studying. I was just working to get money during my studies. And
Okay, so this is not work as a psychologist, as a psychologist who works in
prisons. No, that was pedagogical work.
Okay, so it was teaching them. Okay.
Yeah, caring. You know, they lived there at this institution, and I had to cook for them and so on.
Okay, so then you said later on you started putting together statistics on Muslim crime, and you said we have to look at the Quran. Were you reading the Quran yourself?
Yeah, I studied it quite a lot to understand. That was later when I became a psychologist and I worked in the prison, and I decided to study it, and also some of the the hadith to simply learn about the religion and the cultural background of my clients.
Now you worked with a lot of Muslim and non-Muslim prison inmates. How long did it take you to start putting together information, and what was the information you put together?
Well, I worked there for 3 years, and I had, I think, was it about 150 clients or so of Muslim background, and about 100 of Danish background, and it came step by step, and a lot of it also came afterwards, after I stopped working there, when I started really putting together my experiences and lining them up and so on. And as you can also, if you Google my name, you'll find a few articles from me, and there you'll find that I found four major psychological differences between people of Muslim, with a Muslim background, and people with a Western background.
Could you share that? Like, I've read the article that you recommended, and I've read a couple of other things by you, like the Jihad Watch article, but most of the people who will be listening, this is going to be their introduction to you. So, so you say you found four major differences. What were they?
Well, the first is the first is the view on anger. While we in the West are brought up to think that anger is a sign of weakness, and I think especially in North Europe, but also everywhere else in the West, showing anger and bursts of anger is it's a shortcut to lose face. I think everybody who tried to, you had a burst of anger at their work, or maybe during a family meeting or something, and then we will feel that the day after, you know, we need to talk a little bit louder and act a little bit more friendly in order to feel accepted socially. So, and generally we think that here in the West, big dogs don't have to bark because they know they're big. Only small dogs have to bark. Because being angry and so on is a way of showing that we're not in control and we need to put in force in order to get what we want and so on. While in Muslim culture, anger is simply seen as a sign of strength. And that's why it's also used much more as an accepted social tool in social gatherings and social disputes and so on. And when we show lack of anger and so on in conflicts, and we try to come in with compromise and dialogue and democracy and so on, to them it's seen as weakness. We see their anger and aggression as childish and embarrassing, but to them we seem weak. That's the first difference.
And then the second one?
Yeah, the second one concerns self-confidence, where we would say in the West that meeting criticism with honesty. if we think that it's true what we are criticized about, we would say thank you, and thank you for pointing that out, and I will learn and develop from that. And if it's not true, we would just shrug our shoulders and say, okay, thank you for your advice, but I still think I'm right. And I believe in, I trust myself and so on. So I will stay with that. So for us, self-confidence is being able to handle criticism in a mature way. while this what you see in Muslim culture, you see this, the whole concept of honor makes especially the men very fragile, you know, very, very vulnerable to criticism. And if you criticize, you'll see they blow up and, you know, and become very, very aggressive and so on. And to them, it's seen as very honorable to act aggressively and out of, as you know, out of control and so on when they're criticized. But seen from a Western psychological perspective, we would say that it's insecurity. It's a complete opposite. So that's the second thing, you know, the whole thing concerning self-confidence. And the third thing is then concerns what is, within psychology, it's called locus of control. Locus of control means how we experience our life as being shaped, why things happen. And here in the West, we would think that, we mainly think that if something happens, it's because we created the situation ourselves. It's a result of the way we think, the way we speak, the way we act, the way we react to the situation, and so on. And that's also, you know, like, yeah, if you go to the library, you will see hundreds of self-help books that helps people to find a way to change their own life. And, you know, you open any women's magazine or men's magazine, there will be a lot of suggestions on how we ourselves are in control of our life and can change it ourselves. So we have inner locus of control here in the West. We understand our life as being guided by ourselves. In Muslim culture, it's a complete opposite. They have outer locus of control. There, everything happens inshallah, as they call it, God willing, or Allah willing. And almost every aspect of life is regulated by outer male authorities and outer religious and cultural traditions and rules and laws. And this leaves very little space for the individual to develop the feeling of personal responsibility for their own life. And their main reaction to problems, personal problems, is therefore also that they blame outer factors, they blame other people, other cultures, and so on.
Mm-hmm. With the Danish cartoon, you offended me, you're wrong, because I'm offended and you did it.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah, when kill each other, shooting, bombing, or just in these stampedes where they demonstrate in front of the embassies and then run on top of each other and so on and kill each other. By that, they say that it's a Danish cartoonist who killed all the people and not themselves and so on. It's completely ridiculous, of course. Mm-hmm. Their culture leaves very little insight into simple cause and effect.
Now, if I'm counting right so far, you've given me three differences.
Yeah, now the last one concerns identity.
Yes.
And that here in the West, we are to some extent, we're taught to be open and tolerant, and being open and tolerant is seen as a very positive human trait. And being proud of what we are and being aware that our societies are the most successful in world history. In many areas, is not considered very polite or very good. So we should be brought up to be open to other cultures and in some cases even being too open, as we see now here, where we are embracing a culture that is definitely hostile and definitely a religion that is definitely against the law. It makes us tolerant and open, but it also leaves us very vulnerable, and also it is harmful to our ability to discriminate. You see, Muslims, on the other hand, they are brought up to be exactly the opposite. They're brought up to be proud of being Muslim. They're brought up to think that they are better, they are more important, they're worth more, and they should dominate, and so on. And this is also the reason why when you work in prison, for example, with Muslims, you will see that unless it concerns women, or rivaling Muslim gangs, their victims are always non-Muslim. Mm-hmm. Because they're taught that Muslims are, no matter from what, which country they come from, what skin color or what hair color or whatever, they belong to the same group, they belong to the Ummah.
Mm-hmm.
And you don't go against the Ummah as a Muslim.
It's an incredible thing. Here's a society which has incredibly good values, and it doesn't,
yeah,
and incredibly wonderful, and so many amazing achievements, and it,
yeah,
doesn't value itself. And on the other side, you have a society that is repressive, rigid, very few human rights, also a very few scientific advancements, and they think they're great.
Yeah.
It's like the opinions are on the wrong side. And also it sounds like Western society hasn't learned to do any balance, like a balance between I'm open and yet I value myself. I start with valuing myself and I will check the values of the other.
Exactly, yeah.
And the other one is too closed, so it keeps everything out, and the Western one is too open. So,
yeah,
it's a
I think behind all that religious pride, religious pride, you could call it, an ethnic pride and so on, you see among Muslims, there is a lot of insecurity,
mm-hmm,
because it is, of course, very obvious to everybody that they are, when it comes to yeah, almost everything, development of societies, as you mentioned, scientific development and so on, they are on the last place in this race.
Mm-hmm. My own thought is, as you said, look at the Quran. They have,
yeah,
looked. We have looked. I think that,
yeah,
that would give you a big reason to be fragile when you look at it.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. If you believe in the Quran, you say that represents what I stand for and my opinions and so on, you are sitting duck.
Mm-hmm.
Everybody can come and criticize because, and that makes them so vulnerable. And at the same time, being taught to be angry, being taught to be proud, being taught,
mm-hmm,
to protect your honor, being taught that whatever mistake you have, it's somebody else's fault, and so on, then of course you become very fragile, and that's what we see now. The whole Middle East is exploding because of some movie that is actually not satire, it's not making fun of, it's a documentary.
Mm-hmm.
It shows their prophet, not the prophet, but their prophet, always their prophet, of course.
Mm-hmm.
So it's their prophet the way he was.
The only thing is that it's not very positive about him, but I would say it's rather difficult to make a video of that and be very positive about
it. He caught the head of 600 Jews when he came to a thing.
I know. It's their dominant,
yeah,
myth. And then the women all got raped.
Yeah, yeah.
And including Muhammad took one because he found her extra pretty, and he kept one. And I'm going...
And he had 13 wives, and one of them were only 6 years old, and so it's quite perverse, very perverse, actually. Yeah.
Yeah. No, I remember when I first got a reference to his being... what's the word for a child molester? I went, oh my God, here's a real Islamophobe. And then I was told, no, that's right. He did do that. So really astounding.
Yeah.
And then as a Muslim, you have to see other people seeing those things.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay, so...
must be very embarrassing. Like your crazy uncle is suddenly getting up and, you know.
Yeah.
Oh my God.
Oh no, what else did he do? Whoa. Oh, yes,
yeah, yeah.
To a donkey. Right, of course.
Everyday
behavior. Now,
yeah.
Okay, so you already, before you were a psychologist, were interested because of this one rape that you heard of. Then you met the three men. Then you had all your prison experiences. Could you tell people a bit about, okay, you got these things, you processed them somehow. How did you come,
mm-hmm,
to taking them, speaking out, and what has the response been? What's happened with your life?
Well, I started writing, as I told you, started contacting newspapers, and I think I have now more than 600 letters now printed in different newspapers in Denmark. And, yeah, writing articles for different blogs and different internet magazines, and At one point, at my job, I was invited to a conference on religious extremism and criminal immigrants. Mm-hmm. And there, I think we were around 300, and apparently I was the only one who had a critical view on Islam. There was also, I think, at least 50 spokesmen and imams and representatives of Islamic organizations were also present. And I simply stood up, grabbed the microphone, and said that we shouldn't talk about criminal foreigners because, as you also mentioned in the start of this interview, all foreigners, except for Muslim foreigners, are less criminal than Danes are. And when it comes to religious extremism, it's not all religions. It concerns Islam, and I gave him a few quotes from the Quran. And after that, I was threatened physically, and also my boss at my work was contacted by his boss, and told that he was told that he had a racist, Islamophobic psychologist working in his prison, and I should get fired if I were to repeat my statements.
Now, and I have a question for you, Nikolai, because this is the bigger question than Muslims. What's going on in the West? Because this is truly and utterly crazy. You're not lying. You didn't make any of this up. If you were lying, I can understand it. I could actually understand them sending you to a psychologist and finding it out. But instead, all you're doing is telling things that are self-evident truths. They can check your information and they will come to the same conclusions. So please, psychologist, what's going on?
I hope I could give you a very precise answer. I would love to, but I can't. But it seems that we are a little bit acting like these very, you know, very compassionate pedagogues playing table tennis with disabled person or somebody who is very unable to play table tennis, and in order not to hurt that person, we imagine that we even worse at table tennis at this and that person, and then we lose, let ourselves lose. It's for some reason we're afraid of winning, and we're afraid of showing that we are better and so on.
It is totally crazy to me.
Yeah. And there are a few social psychological factors that could be involved as well.
Okay.
I even wrote an article about it. It's called Psychological Explanations on Political Correctness. Because I think it is political correctness, and many people don't speak up about this. And the first explanation could be what is called the bystander effect. The bystander effect was phrased in 1964 when a woman called Kitty Genovese was murdered in front of her home, and her neighbor just stood watching and did nothing while she was murdered. And made a lot of psychological research in this apparently very typical tendency in people. And it seems that when a catastrophe happens or something bad happens, and there's a group of people watching, then people are not sure if they should act or not. And what happens is that they look at each other and see the reactions of the other people in order to decide what to do. And if everybody stands and waits for somebody else to do something, then of course nobody does anything, do anything. So this could be one explanation. Some people are watching and waiting, and something is wrong here, but I'm not the first who's going to act. What are the other people doing, and should I do anything, and so on. And in the end, nobody does anything. That's also why it's so important that somebody does something, like you do now with your interviews and so on.
And you with your writing and all of us.
Yeah, a lot of people are working, you know, spending a lot of free time they could else, you know, they could spend with their families or earning money or whatever, just relaxing and enjoying life instead of spending time on actually a lot of things that is not very pleasant to read and so on. And the second explanation could be what is called pluralistic ignorance. And pluralistic ignorance comes when people are fear criticism. So everybody knows something is wrong, but also everybody fears that if they speak out, they will be criticized. And in the end, because nobody dares to speak out, the majority of people will vote against their own gods, will vote against what they believe in.
Mm-hmm.
So this is also typical social psychological tendency.
Mm-hmm.
And also here, I think it's very true that a lot of people know that something is wrong. I know it from my colleagues at work and other places, that a lot of people know that something's wrong here. Islam is not a religion of peace, and Muslim immigration and so on is a very big problem. But they don't dare to speak out because so many people don't dare to speak out. It ends up that we again vote for the politicians who invite more Muslims to our countries and.
A crazy thing is that voting is done in private, so people don't even dare vote in private for what they believe.
Yeah, that's crazy. But then they can go and tell their friends, you know, again, I voted for the left, as I always do, and like you always do, and now we're all good people, and we do as we always did, and so on, right? And okay, that's apparently important to people. And then the last year, and that's completely my own, but it seems that all through history, there has been, in all cultures, a definition of good people. What is a good person? And to us, a good person, as we also talked about before, a good person is a person who is open and tolerant. And if we are critical against a religion, or if we are critical against a certain group of people or a certain culture, then we go against this principle.
Mm-hmm.
And according to the normal Western definition of a good person, we are not a good person anymore. And people need to, especially insecure people, need to feel good and so on. That's why people do things like this.
So you're talking about Muslim insecurity, and then now you are talking about Western insecurity. You're saying Western insecurity.
Yeah, exactly, and cowardice.
Cowardice, yes.
Yeah.
I have a question that I ask for everybody. First of all, what do you see any potential solution for this? Because what I see is that, as far as I know, multi-generational, you know, people have been in Denmark for generations, like their ancestors outnumber immigrants. And yet, even though there's a problem, the doors are not being blocked. Is there any way that you see of protecting Danish society? And by extension, other quote-unquote tolerant, walk over me, I'm a doormat societies?
Yeah, I'm sorry to tell you, Elsa, but the point where we could avoid blood, sweat, and tears is we crossed that point a few decades ago here in Europe. I'm sorry to tell you that. The way back would be to make, you know, yes, to enforce the law on Islam. Which we don't. We have the laws we need. We have laws that forbid criminal religions, that tells people to kill other people and suppress women and suppress people who have other religions and so on. But we don't enforce them. There will of course come a day where we'll feel where we will enforce the law more than we do now. But at that time, it will not be, you know, people of different religions for just throwing flowers at each other and see who can throw most flowers at each other and so on. It will not be nice. Already now it's not nice in Europe. I tell you that. Maybe if you live in a place where I live, you know, far out in the country and so on, or if you live in a rich area with not many Muslim immigrants, you may not see this, but a lot of people now, thousands and millions of normal, you know, original Westerners, you know, who are not Muslims and so on, they are forced to live with Muslims now, and they are starting to feel what is going to come to all of us, namely that there is a very aggressive tone against non-Muslims from Muslims, and very violent also, and it cannot be stopped without the use of force.
What is the percentage in Denmark of Muslims?
I think it's not so much. It's like 5% or so.
And so 5% of the population, you're saying, is terrorizing 95%?
No, it's not terrorizing 95%. It's maybe terrorizing 10%, because a lot of Danes, they don't live with Muslims and don't live, you know, in the Muslim ghettos. They can afford to move and live elsewhere. But there are a lot of Danes and a lot of Europeans who cannot afford to, and who are forced to live in these neighborhoods and so on, and they're being terrorized. And this we see now happening more and more, also in the small towns now around Europe. And more people are experiencing this, also in the schools and so on.
Do you have any suggestions? You're saying that Westerners think they have an internal locus of control, but they don't seem to actually have an internal locus of control except fear. So the outside world is not saying you must be afraid, but inside them, people are so much not acting. What I also hear from you is that you're not seeing, oh, we're going to turn things around in the next 5 years.
No, I don't think so. And the main thing is we have to stop immigration from countries where that has proven not to be, where people have, that what we have to do is we have to stop immigration from countries where it has turned out that people from those countries cannot integrate into our societies. And we have to stop Islamization of our countries, because that increases religious extremism. And we have to enforce the law on Islam.
What law needs to be enforced?
Yeah, laws that forbid criminal religion.
So you would have
laws that we have the Constitution in Denmark. Paragraph 67 says that we have freedom of religion, but only to the extent, only for religions that does not cause disturbance in of public order.
Mm-hmm.
And genocide and killing Jews, killing Christians, killing non-believers, and so on, is definitely a disturbance of the public order.
Is anyone trying to bring the Quran to court in Denmark?
I don't think anybody has tried yet. Of course, a lot of people are talking about it, but for some reason, nobody has tried.
Okay, because I'm going, there are a lot of educated Danes around. It's like there's a paralysis that I see, not among all people. I see that people like you and the people I'm interviewing more and more are active in many ways, including by making the time to speak with me, when you could just be, you know, enjoying the end of the day, going for a walk outdoors, your kids are asleep, maybe reading a book that you'd like to read, maybe reading a romantic comedy. Instead, you're talking with me about doom and gloom, the potential incredibly difficult times ahead for Europe.
Yeah.
So that's why I ask, I think I get your hopes and fears. You think that there are very tough times ahead in Europe and maybe the rest of the world. Am I right
clearly
about that?
Clearly they are. Of course they are. If you see the development the last decade, you know, just the last decade since 9/11, you know, you see an explosion of violence, an explosion of parallel societies where secular democratic laws no longer exist, where Sharia is enforced, where the police cannot go anymore. Also in Denmark.
This is also in Denmark. Okay.
It's all over the place. Yeah.
And despite the fact that everyone in Denmark knows this, the law is not enforced.
Of course, a lot of the ghettos and so on, the police are trying to enforce the law. They're not doing enough, and it seems that the leaders in the police, the chiefs, are politically motivated. It seems that there are political powers that are able to influence the police for some reason. I don't know how it works, but it seems that it is like that.
You would think that, let's say, a police officer on the beat would see what was going on.
I also know normal police officers, you know, who are working on the street and so on. They have Islamonausea, as we call it, Islamonausea.
Uh-huh.
And they simply had enough, you know, and they know something is wrong, and they know it's going to explode. And also sometimes it does explode, you know, with bombs and, you know, threats and shootings on the street between Muslim gangs and the police and so on. But as for some reason, their leaders don't want them to really do something about the problems for real.
If your vision 5-10 years down the road, do you see any ways of trying to make things better, or what do you see in Denmark in 10 years' time?
I see what the problems we have now, just much worse. And we will, of course, see that political parties who are critical against Islam, they will get more votes. That means that also the police will work more directly against the problems, and our courts will work more directly against these problems. And that means that also the Muslim society will feel more under pressure, and they will react. And we will see violent tensions. We will see that what we have now is very strong ethnic tensions, and they will come up in a very violent way. I have no doubt about it.
You started by speaking about anger and the West's often denigration of anger. I know in my own family, anger was something to be ashamed of. If you lost your temper, it was, how could you? But under that also, there is, because people haven't learned often to be angry constructively and strongly, so people are actually afraid of anger. Mm-hmm. People who haven't learned to be able to be angry forcefully and take their power, to use language like that, a thing is real fear of that anger, as opposed to standing
up. What we don't have enough of, I think, is actually compassion. Because if we could see how much Muslims harm themselves by living the way they do, how much Muslims, imagine living in a Muslim society, you cannot choose your own partner. You cannot choose who you make love with. Imagine what a Muslim man does to himself when he beats his woman or limits the freedom of his wife. You harm yourself. You harm your own access to feel love, to feel intimacy and all those things. The people who act bad are not, if you ask me, are not evil. They're suffering. They're just acting out what they feel inside and what they're told to do and so on. And these people are hurting themselves and harming themselves. If we could see that we should stop them not out of anger but out of compassion, we would have made a major step. The first victims, maybe not the biggest victims of Islam, but definitely the first victims of Islam are Muslims themselves.
Yeah, so you were saying if we look at them with compassion, I'm going, though, it has to be a strong compassion, because usually most people who are compassionate won't stand up for themselves.
And here you see a lot of people harming themselves and their surroundings, and you should stop it. And you find ways to stop it.
I want to find out what to do. What do we do?
That's why to a large extent, this is, until now, we are at a stage where you could call it an information war, where our media is bought, a lot of our media is bought by Arab money. A lot of people are afraid of speaking out, so a lot of facts don't come out. And newspapers are afraid to lose readers if they write too much about the problems, because then they would come out as conservative or even racist. So what we need to do, first of all, is to spread information. Spread information about Islam, about the consequences of Muslim immigration, and so on. That's the main thing we should do. We can do that, everybody. Everybody can learn to talk in a very relaxed, you know, not very excited, not very missionizing way about things like these, you know, and only talk about when other people bring the topic on the table and so on, and then only, you know, in a slow way, but, you know, we can do that, everybody. We can send a few emails to friends or post something on Facebook if we are there and so on. It's possible.
So everyone needs to do more on information.
Yes, they feel like it, you know. But I think for most people, it could feel natural to, you know, to get to know what's going on and also to pass on information. That, mm-hmm. that would be very helpful, of course. Also writing letters to newspapers and also supporting people, you know, like with money for organizations and people who spend their time on working on the shop. You know, that would be very, very nice if we could do that once in a while. I'm not talking about myself. I don't collect any kind of money for what I do, but I know that we live from this and need to live from it because they don't have time to work and so on because they're so involved.
About how much time do you put into things to do with Islam?
On a daily basis, I don't know. A couple of hours, I think.
Well, that's a lot. It works out to 15 hours a week.
Yeah, it is. I guess it is, yeah.
Yeah, you could put it into flower gardening.
Yeah, that'd be a waste of time. I'm not very good at gardening.
Okay, so you're much better at this. Okay, so is there anything you would like to tell people? Any last words, messages?
Learn to talk about the things in a friendly way and without making people, you know, feel that you're crazy or pushing too hard. You know, learn to be good in a friendly way and what else? Don't be afraid to speak out and so on. Nobody does it out of anger. We all do it because we know it's out of compassion for our own societies, for our children and grandchildren's future. And if we're able to, then also, you know, in order to help the Muslims to live more free lives and lives, but they can also start to share the human qualities that everybody has inside and that everybody are able to develop. That would be very nice if we do it like that.
How good is the education system for reaching through to Muslim children?
Not very good. Not very good. We right now we have a very big discussion in Denmark these days, right now as we talk, because a female school teacher in the middle of Denmark at an island called Funen, she's in an act of frustration, I guess, set out that she was just so tired of all the Muslim students that constantly ruined, you know, the classes and the teachings in the classes and so on. And now she's accused of racism and have to go to court and so on. But now other school teachers and parents of non-Muslim students are stepping out and saying that, backing her up and saying that she's actually right.
That it's a very frustrating thing dealing with students who are not part of the school, you know, who are working against the class functioning well.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And if you have a few and there's no pattern, okay, then it's just the usual couple of percentages. But if you have a whole group that, and they're all coming from the same religion and have the same background and so on, and they're all acting more or less the same, or a very big part of them are, then there is a pattern. It's a problem that we should resolve. I'm not sure it can be solved, but we should at least try, and at least we should be able to talk about it.
Absolutely. And it sounded like she did it accidentally. So that's a potential solution. Someone explodes, and her life goes on the firing line, and we'll see what happens with that.
Yeah.
Thank you so much for your time. I have there's so much coming from you. I especially found it very interesting the looking at psychologies, ours and Muslim psychologies. What's going on? Because how can you act against something you don't recognize? Do you have any final things, books you'd want someone to read, words or messages?
Well, I would keep very alert on this. I don't think you find a lot of useful information in our newspapers. Either they're bought by Arab money or they are on the influence of political correctness. But I would take a look once in a while at a few blogs like Jihad Watch and EuropeNews.dk and... Actually, there's a new, very good newspaper coming out. It will start publishing from January 13. It's called Dispatch International. I know the people behind it, and it's very good. If you could spread that, you know, and maybe even subscribe and so on, it would be very good. Dispatch International. Yeah, and a also another homepage called thereligionofpeace.com, I think, which is also very useful. So you look at those places and see if there's something you could post on Facebook or send to a couple of friends or inspire you to write a letter to a newspaper somewhere. And that'd be very good.
Okay, well, I want to thank you for talking. It's getting late where you are after 10 o'clock. That's my final message to you. Thank you, and I hope that the future is not as bleak as you make it out, but I know that there is very serious stuff happening.
Yeah, we will see. And thank you for calling us. I'm very happy to join your show here, and thank you for doing what you do, and I hope you have a lot of success with that. You deserve it.
Thank you.